This is February 5th, 2012. And for my Teisho this morning, I'm going to talk about ordination. We have an ordination ceremony coming up this coming Saturday. And I think there's a lot of confusion about what it means and doesn't mean. And I thought I would try to sort out what is actually quite a complicated thing as far as different systems of ordination. Just a little disclosure here. I was caught up in the commercial airline Bardo until 3 o'clock this morning, and having spent 8 hours in Washington Dulles Airport, so I may get a little hoarse as we go on, but that's all it is. But I'm so happy to be back. You know, just even a week away, it reminds me of why I got ordained. But more on that later. Just a little history. I feel obliged to, especially for newer people who don't know this, that for basically all of Buddhist history, 2,500 years until the Dharma landed in the West, in the Americas, in Europe, to be a serious Buddhist meant to be ordained as a monk or nun. Actually, in the very earliest times, monastic ordination was open only to men. And another disclosure here, the Buddha had to be persuaded by his great disciple Ananda to open the monastic order to women, which he eventually did. This has to be understood in terms of the social, cultural context of ancient India. But to make a serious commitment to the Dharma meant to be ordained in to receive celibate ordination. And it was for lay people, those who weren't monks or nuns, the most they could hope for is to earn merit by supporting the monastic order so that they could get enough merit that in their next life, perhaps, or at least a life before too many more lives, they could have the good karma to be able to become a monk or a nun. And there's great support for monastic ordination in all the Buddhist texts. One of the strongest statements for becoming a monk comes from the great Japanese Zen master Dogen. This is from the 13th century, who opens one of his chapters in his great work, the Shobogenzo. He quotes, he's quoting Nagarjuna. Nagarjuna, those of you who are familiar with our ancestral line that we chant will know that name, one of the great, great Indian ancestors, Buddhist ancestors. And here Dogen quotes him, "The Bodhisattva Nagarjuna asked himself, if we follow even the Buddhist precepts for laymen, we can be born in the celestial world, attain the way of bodhisattvas, and realize enlightenment. Why then is there any need to follow the precepts for monks?" The precepts for laymen is basically the receiving the precepts that we do twice a year, what we call jukai, in a ceremony, usually in the Buddha hall. That's what he's referring to, the Nagarjuna is referring to here. if we follow even the precepts for laymen, we can, just to simplify this, we can receive a good rebirth and realize enlightenment. Why then become a monk? And then in answer to his own question, he, Nagarjuna, replied, although it is true that both laymen and monks can realize enlightenment, there is a difference in the relative difficulty each encounters. Because laymen have to make a living, it is difficult for them to devote themselves completely to Buddhist training. If they attempt to do so, their livelihood will be endangered, while if they do the opposite, they must necessarily neglect their practice of the way. To attempt to do both at the same time is not an easy matter. On the other hand, it is much easier for monks, being free of worldly responsibilities and various distractions, to devote themselves to the practice of the Dharma. The same thing is true in regard to the realization of enlightenment. So, in other words, to make it simple, it's all about simplicity, simplifying one's life. And anyone who has gone to Sesshin, where it's about as simple as you can get, where the structure and the daily schedule is about as simple as you can get, knows the value of simplifying one's life. This is how we more easily reach the essentials of life and death. Simplifying. And then, again, Nagarjuna just repeats, laymen find it difficult to realize enlightenment because of the great amount of work they must do, the disorder and clamor in their lives, and the fact that they must live among worldly desires. Monks, on the other hand, are able to go out and meditate in deserted fields, thereby controlling their minds and realizing the essential emptiness of all things. So that's, if we just move along here, that's the basics of traditional monastic ordination in Asia. And we tried that here. In the early years, there were three very ardent practitioners, Casey Frank, John Sheldon, and Jeff Volk. This is the early 70s, who did persuade Roshi Kaplow to ordain them in the traditional way as celibate monks. All three of them withdrew. And it was after that that Roshi Kaplow agreed to adopt the predominant system of ordination in this country and in the Americas and Europe, which is what we call priest ordination. Now, priest ordination has been the system in Japan, actually, for a long time. I think it goes back to 1867, maybe. And until then, the Japanese also maintained this celibate monastic ordination. But then they switched. There are historical reasons for it, which I don't have time to get into. But they switched to this model of where you're ordained, and then you have the option of getting married or not. And that's still the situation in Japan, and that's what we have adopted here and what almost all other Zen centers have adopted. In fact, I know of virtually no ordination in the traditional monastic sense, in the celibate sense, in the West or in Europe. There must be, I don't know, all centers, but I've been around for a long time and have gone to some eight or so of our annual Zen teachers meetings, and I don't know, it's negligible, the number of traditional celibate monks. Just to mention a little bit of my own personal history with regard to this, I was inspired by the example of the three here in the early 70s who received monastic ordination, and I actually persuaded Roshi Kapler to do the same, and then we had sort of agreed that we would go ahead with it after sometime after an upcoming sesshin, and then I went to the sesshin and spent half the sesshin thinking about what I wouldn't be able to do as a celibate monk, which actually was mostly around not being able to visit my family again, my parents or my sisters. That's what came up most strongly in the sesshin. So I came out and dragged myself into his office and said that I told him what I had spent sesshin doing, and he said, "Well, you're not ready to be a monk then. Get out of here." But I still felt this longing to go as far as I could, as far as I was able to, given that limitation of not being able to sever, not being able to sever ties with my family or have any kind of worldly life again. And so then when the three monks all withdrew, as someone very, very nicely summed it up when they heard about this, these three who withdrew as celibate monks, monks belong in a monastery. It's exceedingly difficult for anyone to maintain vows of celibacy when embedded in a sangha of both sexes. And throughout time, monks have lived in monasteries, segregated from the opposite sex. Actually, a few years later, another guy here, who was on staff at the time, hammered away at Roshi Kapler for months and months and months, and finally convinced him to ordain him as a celibate monk. Lasted, I don't know how long, a couple years, 4 or 5 years in that, and then fell in love with a woman and withdrew, and his 23-year-old son came to the last workshop. So maybe someday we can do this. I tend to think, and this is just musings, but I tend to think that as a people we have not suffered enough for monastic ordination to really take hold, to really get traction in this country. In these traditional cultures of Asia, all traditional cultures, suffering was so much more vivid and present, ubiquitous, really. Here we have found the most ingenious ways to separate ourselves from basic forms of suffering, the most obvious forms, sickness, old age, and death. And I don't know, who knows? When as a civilization we have declined, you know, as I say, when, not if, because it's the nature of all civilizations to eventually decline. When we have declined and we have all gone through a lot more suffering, then the call of monastic ordination might be stronger for more people. So what we have here at our own center and at virtually all Zen centers in the West is a kind of a hybrid ordination where you become ordained as a priest, but then continue to live among both men and women, and you do the best you can. At most centers, to be ordained as a priest doesn't require that you make any kind of vocational commitment. This might be a surprise to many of you. It was to me when I finally learned that at almost all Zen centers that ordain priests, you get ordained, you maybe keep your head shaved, and get the special robes to wear when you're at the Zen center, but then you go on doing your job, whatever it is, computer programming or working in a hospital or selling shoes or whatever you might be doing. And it was Roshi Kaplow's conviction and mine that as long as we can hold out, we want to require a vocational commitment, which means just to commit to dedicate one's life to the Dharma. That's actually the singular vow in our ordination ceremony. Our priest ordination ceremony is I vow to dedicate my life to the Dharma. And what that means in practical terms is to be working for the Dharma very directly and intimately at a Zen center. Because you can be working for the Dharma in the widest sense, the most profound sense. You can be upholding the Dharma and upholding the Dharma in whatever work you do, whatever it is. Now, there is an exception to that. There are cases where the circumstances of one's life, the circumstances of a priest's life may change, and she or he could find themselves in a situation where, in order to survive financially, they have to take some kind of other employment. The idea behind our ordination is that would always be seen as a temporary thing until circumstances change and one can then again find a sangha that would support one. It gets very complicated because if you're with a small sangha that can't support any staff members, any or priests or other staff members, then you're in trouble. So far, we have the means here to support not just priests, but others in training and residential training. But it's really the spirit behind this commitment that is the important thing. For myself, I just wanted to get absolutely as close to practice and training as I possibly could. I wanted to lash myself to the Dharma as it is practiced in the most the strictest, most intense way. This was largely after I'd gone to a couple of sesshins and knew this was a perfect match for me. And having ruled out monastic ordination, then I knew that I felt certain that I could remain as a functioning priest forevermore after that. And so far it's worked out, thanks to the help of the Sangha, by the way. In another place, Dogen says that entering the monkhood is the most excellent way to express one's faith in the Buddha. And this statement really caught my eye, because I think that's what it comes down to. I hope it is. We've also had priests who have withdrawn from the priesthood. It wasn't just those first three celibate monks. And so I try, as Roshi Kaplow did, I try to be careful about who I ordain, recognizing that we never know how our karma might change in the future. It's the same with marriage. You make a commitment, you take vows to be with someone for the rest of your life, and, well, to be realistic, we change. People change. And when people change, then sometimes other things change. But I start off by requiring that someone spend at least 5 years on staff, residential training here. From time to time, over the years, we've received letters from some young man, usually, who will say, I want to become a Zen monk. And we've learned that that's just sort of his way of saying, I'm really inspired by what I've read about Zen, and I want to take it all the way. So what we've learned to do is, with such a person, is to say, I'm talking about people who aren't even members of the center, is to say, spend a few years on staff first and see, try it out before. I mean, it's so obviously an ideal. Until you have proven yourself with years of actual residential training, then what does it mean to say you want to become a monk? It means you have wonderful ideals. But there are ideals, and then there's the reality. And that can only be our best way of predicting how it's going to work out is through that period on staff. So that's certainly the first thing I look for, is a good length of years of being here and having it really fit, really be a good fit for the person. And then beyond that, yeah, I take my cue from Dogen, and I want to see that the person is wants to be ordained to express her faith in the Dharma. That's what it comes down to. So much faith in this way, this Tao, this Dharma, that you never want to do anything else except this. This meaning working directly, full time, in some capacity, in residential training. In many ways, the life of a priest is that of a staff member, someone here on staff. So why become ordained if you're really living the life of you're living a kind of monastic life here on staff? Not certainly not in the pure sense of having taken any vows of celibacy or having to stay within the monastery walls at all times. But what is the difference? Well, there isn't a lot of difference. And that's what's wonderful about the aspiration to become ordained, is because you're not really gaining anything. It's not done in order to secure some advantage and some status. Okay, yes, there is kind of an intangible status, let's be realistic here, to wearing the blue robes and being a priest. But what really accrues from that? Not much. And that's the way I've always wanted to keep it. That it means that someone who becomes ordained is more likely, and there's no guarantee, but is more likely to be free of motivations of status and more in accord with the underlying spirit of service. I want to see that a prospective priest has the same longing, the same wish to just bow and serve in whatever capacity, the same that I did before I became ordained. And that's hard to know. You know, people who get ordained in Japan also withdraw sometimes. It happens. And we just do the best. I do the best I can to use my best judgment to know when someone someone's going to really stick it out or not. There is a power in taking vows. Many of us who have become married know that there's a difference between living with someone in a married state, but not actually married. There's a difference between that and taking marriage vows. There's a difference between being on staff and getting ordained. If you're on staff, not ordained, you can leave any time. Of course, you can as a priest too, but there is a lot more expectation that you're going to uphold those vows, to those priest vows. I mentioned just now that there is no particular advantage that one will get by becoming ordained, and this reminds me of a misunderstanding that seems to persist year after year. Being ordained as a priest doesn't mean that you're going to be a teacher. It's possible you could be. It's possible that anyone could be. But ordination does not put you on a teacher track. There's ordination and there's sanctioning, teacher sanctioning. Two different things entirely. And you can become a teacher without being ordained. I've sanctioned two of my disciples, Hidaro Sensei and Robert Goldman Sensei, as teachers, and neither is ordained, and I don't think either has any plans to be ordained. Now, this is where I part ways from Roshi Kaplow. Roshi Kaplow felt that if he's going to make someone a teacher, they should be ordained. And I just don't get that. I think if someone is qualified to teach, to guide others with the insight and the commitment to the Dharma and the ability to uphold the precepts and so forth, then why shouldn't they be in a teacher position? On the other hand, I do, now that we have a two-step system for becoming a teacher, I do feel that to be able to confer Dharma transmission on someone else, you need to be a priest. So Roshi Kapu just sanctioned someone as a teacher, and that was it. It's a one-step thing, and they had to be a priest. For me, I've sanctioned people, and then I wait a few years to see how things shake out, and then if I feel they're solid as a teacher, then I'll take the second step. If they're a priest, I'll take the second step and give them Dharma transmission, which gives them the authority to give Dharma transmission. So in a couple weeks, I'm going to New Zealand to do this step two for Amala Sensei, which is giving her full Dharma transmission, even though she's had full teaching authority already for years now. But back to priests. Because there is so little tangible advantage to becoming ordained, and it is such a commitment, how can we not respect those who become ordained? Respect, yes, but not worship. Being ordained doesn't mean that you're free of defilements. This is stating the obvious. Maybe I shouldn't even say that. But being a teacher doesn't mean you're free of defilements. The practice goes on. The work goes on for the rest of our life and future lifetimes. Polishing, purifying the mind. Just as there are different expectations for priests at different Zen centers, there are also different dress codes. What we've adopted long ago was that to become ordained means to have a kind of uniform, not uniform like a military uniform, but to have a uniformity, a same form, a same appearance. Not strictly speaking, but basically wearing some form of blue, for more formal things, navy blue, but other shades of blue as well, and keeping the hair short, not shaved to the skin. I don't think that's necessary. In Japan, I spent about 6 months there. You shave your head. Those who are ordained shave their heads every 5 days. Every date with a 4 and a 9 in it, they're required to shave their heads. I found that you spend so much time on your appearance, shaving your head every 5 days. If you think it's easy to shave your head, try it sometime. Especially, well, at one temple there, Bukokuji, all you had were razors. And it just, I think the Tibetans are more sensible about this. They don't feel you have to have a gleaming head all the time. They keep their hair very short, and I think that's sensible. Otherwise, you can just obsess too much about your head. So, and also, in more casual, everyday wear here at the Zen Center and staff, we kind of broaden that to not just blue, but maybe gray sometimes, and black. Actually, in the early years, when I first became ordained, we were expected to wear only black. And, we did that for, about 5 years. And then we just felt that, first of all, we were too often mistaken for Catholic priests and martial artists. And we got tired of frying in the sun in the summer because, this was before black became so fashionable, but black absorbs heat. And we finally ganged up on Roshi Kapolo and said, can't we switch to navy, blue, and maybe with other on certain occasions black and maybe gray, but and he yielded, and that's what it's been ever since. So in other words, some sense of being in an order, certain color, certain cut, the collars are we expect the collars to be what we might call a banded collar, not the conventional collar that turns down, but a simple banded collar, a little like the Nehru collar. And to take a Dharma name that one uses instead of one's given first name. And this was a big surprise to me. I kind of cringed at the thought of giving up my name, Peter, just because it was my name. But I came out of that ceremony, out of my ordination ceremony, and I suddenly realized the wisdom behind changing your name. I know that to some people this seems cultish, and I understand that. But boy, it is quite wonderful for people not to be addressing you the way they have your whole life. It is a feeling of a new beginning, a rebirth. And so we have maintained that aspect too, of keeping, having someone use a new name. We haven't, full disclosure here, we've never required that someone legally change their name. My name on my driver's license is still Peter Colheed. When I think about that, I wonder, what's wrong? At the time, this is in the mid-70s, everyone said, oh, it's so hard to change your name, but it can be done. So I don't know what I'm waiting for. I got to change that last name anyway. I've been meaning to do that for years. Get that J out of it. Now that both of my parents are gone, I might, any day now, I might get around to getting rid of that J. Anyway, now, how much time do we have? All right. I mentioned about how those who dedicate their lives to working directly, intensely for the Dharma are deserving of respect. I don't think I need to tell most people that. Because it just the evidence is that people do respect priests, but it can get kind of weird with envy stirred into it. And what I've seen is that those who that priests, especially new priests, can be the object of an unseemly amount of fault finding on the part of others in the Sangha. And I think that one reason for that is envy, envying that kind of commitment, feeling that one would like to oneself, but who knows? But this is something I think to be aware of, to be on guard about, is demanding too much of priests, as much as anyone else, certainly, as much as any staff member, and we expect priests, since they are, even if intangibly they're in a position of authority, we have in our ethical guidelines special expectations of priests in terms of boundary issues and relations to others. Monks belong in a monastery, not in a sangha with both sexes. In many Zen centers, they would refer to lay ordination. And we thought about that for a while, but Roshi Kaplan and I both felt it's really a oxymoron. If ordination is going to mean... We've already reduced the commitment of ordained people drastically by not requiring celibacy and so forth. So we don't use the word. It's enough, I feel, it's enough to have done that without then making it completely amorphous into this thing called lay ordination. So we don't use that word. Lay investiture, not to make this too complicated, but lay investiture is a word we use for those in the Three Jewels Order who are not priests. You're a lay member of the Three Jewels Order, but I don't want to get into that word lay ordained, although it's very common at other centers. But even worse, I think, is to refer to our priests as monks, and this is a real pet peeve of mine. At other centers, to become ordained in the way that we ordain people, where you still do have the option of becoming married, means they start calling them monks. And this is not fair to true celibate monks. That's a great commitment. That's a really very, very strong commitment to take traditional monastic vows of celibacy and leaving the home. And I think it's unfair to the thousands or tens of thousands maybe of Chinese monks, Vietnamese monks, Tibetan monks and others, for us to use that word for those who can still get married. I think that it is nothing more than an effort to kind of inflate the position by calling them monks. I once saw an article in the San Francisco Chronicle someone sent me. It showed a shaven-headed guy from the San Francisco Zen Center with a kid on his shoulders, and said, a monk, a San Francisco Zen Center monk with his jaw, rah, rah, rah. Why do we need to do that? The most I would see is a monastic, the word monastic in the noun form. Okay, we could say that any staff member, you know, living here, submitting to all of the structure, the daily schedule, the residential schedule here, could be called a monastic, maybe. Even that's unnecessary. But we're not going to go there and start calling priests or anyone else monks here. A priest, I used to think that a priest meant an intermediary between God and man. And I think in Christianity it can mean that. But we settled on that word priest just by default. We couldn't think of another word. I mean, monk, no. Monastic is a little contrived. I'm not going to go with minister or... and so just maybe someday we'll come up with some other word will spring out of nowhere and we can use that. So for the time being, we're saying priest, and that's one of the definitions in the dictionary that I consulted this morning. One of the definitions of a priest is any clergyman or religious minister. There's that word religion again. I think in the last Teisho here, I mentioned the root word of religion is religare, which means to bind together. And this is what I would hope for anyone who's becoming a priest, is they want to bind themselves to the Dharma so thoroughly that they can't not be ordained, cannot refrain from taking this step. And beyond that, we want eventually for priests to have been trained in ceremonies, how to conduct ceremonies, how to use Zendo instruments. This is part of the tradition. You can be deeply enlightened and not know how to use any of these do any of these things, be versed in liturgy and ceremonies and so forth. But how helpful it is in preserving the Zen tradition to know these things. There is a Zen lineage in this country and in Europe, which all or most of the teachers, the sanctioned teachers, are not priests, and there have been some troubling effects from that. That I can illustrate from a story, a true story, when our sister center, the Stockholm Zen Center in Sweden, when they first established their country retreat center, like us, as we do, they would rent it out occasionally, and they rented it out once for a sesshin, led by some European Zen teachers, and. They showed up to conduct their sesshin. There were two or three of the teachers, and they invited Sante. At the time, he wasn't a teacher; he was just the leader of the group. They invited Sante to join them in their sesshin, and Sante said, "Sure, why not? Thank you. I'd like to join you." And they invited him also to an organizational meeting they had right before the sesshin began, before the opening ceremony. And they sat in a little circle, these four or five teachers, and someone with a clipboard said, "Okay, who wants to be the lead chanter? Can anyone do that?" And they looked around. No one knew how to be a lead chanter. So they finally turned to Sante and said, "Would you be willing to do that?" He said, "Sure." "What about stick? Who wants to use the stick?" Same thing. Nobody knew how to use a stick. So they turned to Sante. "Sure, I'll do that." And there was a third thing. But so there's just this plain old ordinary learning how to do things that also is part of being ordained that I think is important in preserving sort of the bones of Zen as a tradition. It's much more, Zen is much more than a tradition, but it is a tradition as well. When I came out of my ordination, I could not have imagined the joy I felt. I felt like it was the happiest day of my life. That day, up to that point, that was the happiest day of my life to be ordained. And I think time shows that it was, for me, it was a perfect match. You know, I've never for one hour wanted to do anything else but work here. And I never for a moment had any thought about being a teacher. I can honestly say that. That was the farthest thing from my mind. I mean, I was, what, 28 or something when I was ordained. I had no ambition to become a teacher. I was just trying to hold my own here and come out on top in my battle with my thoughts. But I hope for these two, for Luna and Britta, this Saturday will also be that kind of experience, and that they will hold fast to their vow, and as long as they live. All right. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.